Welcome to the Atomic Podcast. Whether you're a nurse anesthesia resident in CRNA school or an RN trying to get there, you're in the right place.
I'm Sachi, and along with Rhea, we're going to talk all things anesthesia and science, and we're going to bring along some of our friends too.
Join us each week as we dive into all things science and anesthesia. So welcome to another episode of the Atomic Anesthesia Podcast, which is a podcast for nurse anesthesia residents and nurses that are preparing for CRNA school. I'm your host, Professor Rhea Timmerman, and today we're diving into a class of drugs that you've probably encountered on a daily basis in your clinical practice, which are local anesthetics. So as anesthesia providers, we rely on these drugs to block pain sensations in specific areas without causing any kind of loss of consciousness. And these drugs work by inhibiting the conduction of nerve impulses. So from using them for regional blocks to infiltrating the skin in anesthesia, local anesthetics are really an essential tool in our drug arsenal. In this episode, we're going to be exploring the basic chemical structure of local anesthetics and how they're classified, their mechanism of action, and some basic pharmacology principles, some clinical applications, and then some safety considerations and side effects when working with local anesthetics. Now, this episode is meant to be more of an introductory episode. We're not going to get into every single little nitty-gritty detail about its pharmacology. We'll save that for another episode, such as explaining everything about PKA, which is an essential concept for understanding local anesthetics. So, like I said, introductory episode, we're just going to touch a little bit on each one of these topics. So let's dive right into it. The mechanism of action of local anesthetics. So local anesthetics primarily block voltage-gated sodium channels. So these are ion channels that allow sodium to go through. And we say voltage-gated because they are normally opened by action potentials in the nerve. This is opposed to other types of ion channels, which we might call ligand-gated ion channels, which are opened or closed based off of some kind of chemical binding to that channel. So these are voltage-gated sodium channels. And the sodium channel in this situation exists in three kind of functional states or physical forms or manifestations. So it could either be in a resting and closed state, it could be in an open state, or it can be in an inactive state. And to note, local anesthetics bind to specifically the open and inactive states, but they don't bind to the closed state. They actually bind to the sodium channel on the inside of the cell. So we'll get to that in just a second, but they have to cross the cell membrane and connect to and bind to the sodium channel on the inside of that cell. When this blocks the sodium channel, what this does is prevents the depolarization of nerve cells, so no action potentials can occur. So the pain signal is never transmitted to the spinal cord and to the brain, and this causes basically a numbing sensation. So in order for local anesthetics to work, they have to change between two forms. There is an ionized state, and ionized, if you think about the word, it sounds like ion, right? And ions are usually charged. So if they are in an ionized state, they're going to be charged. And in that charged state, they're going to be more water soluble because water is polarized, right? So it has a negative end and a positive end. And because the local anesthetic is charged and the water has a charge, they're attracted to one another. So they're water soluble. The other form it can exist in is the non-state. So this is not going to be charged. And because it's not charged, it's going to be more lipid soluble. And it needs to be in the non-ionized form to diffuse across the cell membrane, because the cell membrane is primarily phospholipids, right? So the local anesthetic has to be in a lipid soluble form in order for it to cross through the cell membrane, because like I said, it binds to the inside of the sodium channel on the inside of the cell. And then it needs to change back to the ionized form, the charged form, in order for it to bind. And this occurs because the inside of the cell in the cytoplasm or the cytosol is slightly more acidic than the outside of the cell. So it's able to then change these different forms. Now, the concept that we talk about a lot with local anesthetics is PKA, which is an acid dissociation constant. And this episode, I mean, talking about PKA would require literally an entire episode on its own. Even when I teach it for anesthesia classes, it takes nearly an hour to describe exactly what PKA is. And it's very confusing for a lot of people. I think a lot of professors also don't truly understand what PKA is. So we'll reserve that for another episode. But for now, it is a concept that we use to understand the behavior of local anesthetics. And by definition, what PKA represents is the pH value in which the compound or the drug is 50% ionized and 50% non-ionized in some kind of aqueous solution. So for local anesthetics, PKA does play a significant role in its pharmacological properties and its clinical effectiveness. So we'll spend an entire episode just dedicated to PKA. Now, local anesthetics are known to be weak bases, and the PKA values for local anesthetics typically range up anywhere from like 7.6 to 8.9-ish. And like I said, the PKA determines the proportion of ionized and non-ionized forms of that local anesthetic at a given pH. Just a reminder, only the non-ionized form can penetrate the tissue and the cell membranes, and the relationship between the PKA and the tissue pH really does affect the speed of onset of the local anesthetic, the potency, and the duration of action. So let me give you one clinical example where this might come into effect. So certain clinical situations, like you're injecting the local anesthetic into an infected tissue, like infected skin. Typically, infected tissue is more acidotic, so a pH of around 5 to 6, which then changes how effective the local anesthetic is. So in this situation, what happens is local anesthetics become more ionized, more charged, and thus it can't penetrate the cell membranes, and then that reduces its effectiveness. But what we can do as providers is we can actually manipulate the pH of the local anesthetic solution and the surrounding tissue. And one way we could do that is by adding a base like sodium bicarb. And what this does is it increases the proportion of non-ionized drug, which then improves the onset time. So that's just one clinical example in which understanding the concept of PKA, pH, acids, and bases kind of plays into something that is like an actual scenario you might encounter, right? So we just need to understand those concepts, and we'll talk about that more in another episode. So, on to the basic structure and the classification of local anesthetics. So, like I said, they are weak bases, and the chemical structure of local anesthetics include on one end an aromatic ring. So, if you remember like what a benzene ring looks like, it looks like a hexagon, right? So, you have that ring on one side, and that ring is its lipophilic side. So, that's the fat-loving side. Then there's an intermediate chain or a link in the middle. And then on the other side is an amine group. And anytime you hear the word amine, think nitrogen, right? Amine, nitrogen, amino groups, nitrogen. So that is going to involve a nitrogen. And usually nitrogen is very positively charged. And so that's going to be your hydrophilic side, so your water-loving side. And local anesthetics are divided into two primary functional groups based on the structure of that intermediate chain or that intermediate link. And those two groups are either esters or they're amides. And an easy way to remember which local anesthetics are in which class, so the word amide has the letter I in it, and local anesthetics in which their generic name has two I's in their name belong in that class. Whereas esters, and I'll read some off to you in just a second, so esters only have one I in the name, and amides have two I's in the generic name. So I'll read off some common examples of each class. So for esters, we have procaine, chloroprocaine, tetracaine, cocaine, and benzocaine. Whereas amides are bupivacaine, so hear that two I there, pivacaine, bupivacaine, ropivacaine, lidocaine, prilocaine, etidocaine, and mepivacaine. So those are your amide local anesthetics. And like I said, they are categorized based on the structure of that intermediate link or that intermediate chain. But otherwise, the structure on the aromatic ring and the amine group on the other side are the same in both classes. Let's move on to pharmacology. We're not going to take a deep dive into pharmacology. This is just an introductory lesson. So we'll talk a little bit about the pharmacokinetics. And pharmacokinetics usually involve ADME, which is absorption, distribution, metabolism, and elimination or excretion. Now, for absorption, now this is really influenced by the site of administration, the way that we administer the local anesthetic, right? So you can inject it, you can deliver it using a cream or some kind of ointment, you can deliver it using a patch or even a spray. And then you can also add things to the local anesthetic like sodium bicarb or epinephrine, which is going to change its onset time or its duration. Now, typically in anesthesia, we are going to inject it either locally in the skin, regionally, so around a nerve that supplies a region of the body like the arm or the leg, or maybe even neuraxially, like in the epidural space or the subarachnoid space for a spinal. So for distribution, and this is how it travels through the bloodstream. Now, normally local anesthetics, we want them to stay local, right? That's why we call them local anesthetics. We want them to stay where we inject them as long as possible. But eventually it starts to get absorbed systemically into the bloodstream and then goes to other parts of the body. Now, part of distribution is protein binding. So protein binding is when the drug binds to a certain blood protein, and when it's bound to that protein, it can't do anything else. It can't affect another ion channel. It can't be metabolized. It can't be excreted. It's usually drugs that are very highly protein bound. You know, those drugs are going to be a little bit longer lasting than drugs that are less protein bound. Now, local anesthetics primarily bind to the protein called alpha-1 acid glycoprotein, but they also sometimes bind to albumin. And of the common local anesthetics that we use, bupivacaine has the highest protein binding at 95%, then ropivacaine at 94%, and then lidocaine at 64%. Those are probably the three most common local anesthetics that we use in anesthesia practice. And like I said, when it's protein bound, it can't have clinical effects or be metabolized. Now let's talk about metabolism. Now, esters and amides are metabolized very differently. And when I talk about this, you'll start to see, and you look at their durations of actions, you'll start to see why ester local anesthetics don't last as long as amide local anesthetics. So ester local anesthetics are actually rapidly metabolized by plasma cholinesterases. These are also known as pseudocholinesterases, and this enzyme is primarily in the plasma, in the red blood cells, and sometimes in the liver. To note, if you're giving cholinesterase inhibitors like neostigmine, that can decrease the metabolism of esters. Also, pregnant patients have decreased levels of plasma cholinesterase. Esters are metabolized into a metabolite called PABA, or para-aminobenzoic acid, and this actually has been associated with allergic reactions, so just keep that in mind. So like I said, local anesthetics, rapidly metabolized by plasma cholinesterases, which are in the blood, in the plasma, and this uses a hydrolysis reaction. Hydrolysis, as you can tell by the name, is adding water to the molecule in order to break it up, break it apart. Amide local anesthetics are primarily metabolized by the cytochrome P450 enzymes, and there are less incidences of allergic reactions with amides as compared to esters because it doesn't break up into that metabolite PABA. Usually, any of the local anesthetic reactions associated with amides are due to more of the preservatives that are in the medication rather than the medication itself. And amides also have a longer duration of action because it just takes longer to be metabolized by the liver as opposed to plasma cholinesterases that are already in the blood. After metabolism, these metabolites are then excreted primarily in the urine. One of the things that I wanted to mention are factors that really affect its systemic absorption. One of those factors is vascularity. If the area that you inject the local anesthetic into is very vascular, then the local anesthetic is going to be absorbed really quickly into the bloodstream. And that's where the role of vasoconstrictors comes in. So oftentimes you might see epinephrine added to the local anesthetic to then vasoconstrict the vessels around the tissue that's being injected so that you can decrease the amount of systemic absorption and increase its duration of action. So let's briefly talk about some clinical scenarios and some clinical considerations in which we might use local anesthetics. So like I had mentioned, they can be administered through different routes. You can give it topically like an ointment, a patch. You can infiltrate it into the tissues, just like maybe right under the skin. You can inject it near specific nerves or into the epidural or subarachnoid space. Now, here are the clinical situations that apply to anesthesia. We inject local anesthetics when we're inserting lines into awake patients. So if we're inserting IVs, A-lines, central lines, we do that by injecting a small amount of usually lidocaine directly under the skin. For epidurals and spinals, we put these in for, of course, labor and delivery. We might do an epidural or a spinal or a combination of both. We might also do epidurals and spinals for some lower extremity procedures like hip replacements, knee replacements. Sometimes we do them for urological procedures, and in a lot of countries outside the United States, a lot of times that's the only option that they have is to do a spinal on somebody and then they are awake for the rest of the procedure. We also do epidurals and spinals for pain procedures, also treating patients with chronic pain. We can give local anesthetics for regional blocks. So we can block up a nerve that supplies an entire extremity or maybe a region of the body. So for example, we have blocks that are called interscalene blocks. This injects local anesthetic, usually bupivacaine, around a portion of the brachial plexus that comes off of the neck and down the shoulder. And surgery that we might use this for might be like shoulder surgery, shoulder replacement. There are blocks called transverse abdominal plane blocks. So these are TAP blocks. And that's when we inject local anesthetic into some nerves that supply the abdominal muscles. So that would help block an incision. Maybe somebody's getting a C-section, or maybe somebody's getting a large bowel procedure in which they'll have a big open incision. So it would block the incision site. It's not going to block the intestinal or the visceral pain, the pain that's in the organs, but at least block one of the most painful parts, which is the incision. You might have other types of blocks, wrist blocks, ankle blocks, axillary blocks, anything to block a certain portion of the limb. We can give them as a spray. So for example, we have like a benzocaine spray that we could spray the back of a patient's throat before they have some kind of procedure like a TEE or an endoscopy. We have children that are given Emla cream, which is a local anesthetic cream and like an emulsion. You put that on their skin and put a Tegaderm on top and leave that on for an hour before they have an IV inserted. More and more, we're starting to see local anesthetics being given via infusions. So we're having things like ERAS protocols during surgery where we're giving them for a form of pain management, because it's going to block sodium channels systemically. So we're giving maybe like a lidocaine infusion for pain management. We can give them IV push. So originally lidocaine was used for, you know, to treat types of dysrhythmias. We have better drugs for that now, but you know, you could still use those for arrhythmias. We actually use lidocaine for just about every single anesthetic induction because we use it to numb the vein before we inject the propofol, which burns really bad. And also that local anesthetic can travel to sodium channels in the airway and numb the airway up a little bit before we do the intubation. We could also use different sprays and injections and creams to numb up somebody's airway before we do a fiber optic intubation. So usually we have somebody whose airway we're really concerned about, we might elect to keep them awake during the fiber optic intubation. So we'll make sure that their airway is super numb before we do something like that. Now, we're not going to get deep into the dosing and the concentration, but I'll give you probably the thing you should pay attention to the most when it comes to dosing local anesthetics is paying attention to the max doses. Lidocaine is different depending on whether you have epi in it or not. So if it doesn't have epi in it, it's usually the max dose is 5 mg/kg. And if it has epi in it, it's around 7 mg/kg. Now, ropivacaine and bupivacaine are pretty easy, actually. Their max dose, I usually round it to about 2.5 mg/kg, and that's the same whether you have epi in it or not. Now, typically bupivacaine, when you're injecting it, is supplied in a concentration of 0.25, and that comes out to 2.5 mg/mL. Just think about what like a 1% concentration, right? We say 1% is 10 mg/mL, so 0.25% is a fourth of that. So a fourth of 10 milligrams is 2.5 mg/mL. Now you notice that if the max dose is 2.5 mg per kg and is supplied in 2.5 mg per ml, then the max dose that you can give is the patient's weight in milliliters. it makes sense when you draw this out, and maybe for a future YouTube video, I'll draw this out for you. But take my word for it. If you have a patient that is 80 kilograms, right, their max dose of ropivacaine or bupivacaine, if the concentration is 0.25%, is going to be 80 mLs. Now, if the ropivacaine or bupivacaine is supplied in a more concentrated form, so let's just say 0.5%, so that would come out to 5 milligrams per ml of that medication, then the max dose is going to be that patient's weight in mLs divided by 50%. So the max dose for an 80-kilogram patient would be 40 milliliters. Like I said, draw out the math on a piece of paper, and then it makes sense when you read these max dosages and how many mLs you can give. I like to do that quick math in the operating room. If a surgeon asks me, oh, how many mLs can I give? Because they're not going to do the math in their head. They just want to know. They have the syringe in their hand, and they just want to know how much they can inject. For most people, you're not going to get close to injecting 80 mLs. It really comes more in handy when you're doing pediatric cases or when you're doing really lightweight adults. This comes more into consideration. Another important thing to note is that this is the total amount of local anesthetic that they've been given for the case. So if you do a regional block and you inject 30 milliliters or 40 milliliters, and then you go into the operating room and the surgeon decides that they're going to inject a lot of local anesthetic at the incision site, that's when you need to start paying a little bit more attention to it, right? Because it's the total between the surgeon and the anesthesia provider. So there's lots of apps out there that you can download that will help you kind of keep track of your local anesthetic and let you know how much more local anesthetic the surgeon can give. Which brings us to toxicity. Now, just because it's a local anesthetic doesn't mean it's without risk. We want the local anesthesia to stay local. We want them to stay in the place that we injected it in. But eventually, that local anesthetic can and does reach systemic circulation. So we want to pay attention to certain signs and symptoms of local anesthetic toxicity and make sure that we take precautions to never get to that point. Now, the toxicity can be categorized into central nervous system toxicity and cardiovascular manifestations. So first, you're going to get the CNS effects, and then last, you're going to get the cardiovascular effects. And when you get to that point, it's pretty bad. So I'm going to just read off a couple symptoms from mild to severe as the concentration of the local anesthetic in the bloodstream starts to increase. And we'll talk a little bit about how we treat this. So for central nervous system signs and symptoms, now in the early kind of lower concentrations, what you're going to see, patients will complain of a perioral numbness or a numbness around their lips and their mouth. They might have a metallic taste in their mouth. They might also have ringing in their ears called tinnitus. Might feel lightheaded or dizzy, might have blurry vision, might have paresthesias in their tongue, or even start to have slurred speech. As it becomes a little bit higher, so a little bit more of a moderate level, they can start to get confused and disoriented or even agitated and restless. They can have a bunch of muscle twitching and tremors. And severe signs, CNS signs you may see are seizures, loss of consciousness, comas, and then respiratory depression or arrest. So cardiovascular signs, some early signs, you will see some hypertension and tachycardia. Moderate signs, you might see some kind of conduction disturbances, like widening QRS, and start to see arrhythmias. And for severe cardiovascular signs, you will see severe hypotension, bradycardia, arrhythmias like BTAC and BFib, and eventually cardiac arrest like asystole or PE. One of the main prevention strategies for this is always aspirating before you're injecting. This especially applies to regional blocks. Now, if you're injecting the skin very locally to put in an IV, that's different. I'm talking when you're injecting a long needle into somebody's neck, into somebody's arm or leg, you always, always, always want to aspirate before you inject, because a lot of times when these signs and symptoms happen, this toxicity happens, is that people inadvertently inject a massive amount of local anesthetic directly into the bloodstream. So if the local anesthetic was injected into the tissue, even though it's the same volume, it just gets slowly absorbed over time into the bloodstream. But it's when you're injecting directly into the bloodstream, a lot of times you'll see patients go into immediate seizures and cardiac arrest. The other thing, like I mentioned earlier, paying attention to your max doses for in the entire case. So situations where this might occur are the anesthesia provider does a regional block, and then the surgeon also is injecting. We're not paying attention to our max doses, and so patients can reach toxicity that way. So like I said, there's a lot of apps out there. You can just type in local anesthesia apps on your iPhone on the App Store, and that'll help you manage the amount of local anesthetic that you've given. Lastly, we'll talk about how to manage local anesthetic systemic toxicity. So first, you want to do the obvious, which is remove the trigger, remove the local anesthetic, don't administer any more local anesthetic. You want to support any of their CNS and cardiovascular functions, so treating seizures with benzos and propofol and initiating ACLS if necessary. But the main life-saving treatment for a local anesthetic toxicity is the administration of a lipid emulsion therapy. This is usually called intralipids. And what it looks like is actually a big bag of like propofol, or it looks like, I think it looks like TPN. It's just a big bag of fat, honestly. And you're going to bolus that at 1.5 mLs per kilogram over 2 to 3 minutes. And then you want to start a continuous infusion of 0.25 mLs per kg per minute. Now, the last therapy should be in a cart everywhere you work. So the same thing with knowing where your crash cart is at, knowing where your MH cart is at. You should also know where that institution is keeping their lipid emulsion therapy. And this is absolutely required for any institution that is administering local anesthetics or doing blocks. If the patient's still unstable, you want to repeat the bolus and you want to double the infusion. And after the patient becomes hemodynamically stable, you want to continue the infusion for another 10 minutes just to make sure. And what this does is it's going to draw the local anesthetic out of the tissue and away from the sodium channels in the heart and the CNS because of their lipid solubility. And it keeps the drug bound to this lipid solution so that it can then be metabolized and then excreted. So overall, that was a introduction to local anesthetics. There's a lot more we could talk about with pharmacology and the differences between the local anesthetics, but I think that's a good start just to kind of figure out how they work, their basic structure and classification, some clinical scenarios in which we use them in, and some signs and symptoms of toxicity and how to treat that toxicity. If you like these pharmacology episodes, definitely hit me up on Instagram or email me at Rhea@atomicanesthesia.com. We have lots of exciting things coming for 2025. We actually just started a monthly webinar. So you're going to go to our website, www.atomicanesthesia.com, and you're going to see links there to sign up for our monthly live webinar. We actually have one coming up January 29th, which is Wednesday. So they're going to be the last Wednesday of every month. And that one's going to be on how to master time management in CRNA school. We have lots of other topics coming up. We have some guests that are going to be on some episodes. We are going to try to record them and upload them to a private YouTube channel for people that are subscribed to that list. So make sure you get on the list so you don't miss that. We also are launching a YouTube channel, which is super exciting. So we just hired a couple professional video editors and we are launching our YouTube channel in February. Most of those topics are going to be anesthesia related, science related, and lots of fun animations and videos coming down the pipeline for that. We're also going to release a graduate roadmap series on our YouTube channel as well that just talks about, you know, how to survive grad school, all the things about just, you know, getting through the tough times in graduate school. And having been in graduate school for a long time myself, I can definitely relate to a lot of the struggles that you're going through right now. So hang in there. Let us know what episodes you want to hear, and we'll see you on the next episode.